Please tell me your name and where you're from.
My name is Art Moran, and I'm presently living in Huron, South Dakota, but I was originally born and raised in Wisconsin. I moved to South Dakota after the war.
And can you tell me in what capacity you served during World War II?
I was a navigator on B-17 heavy bomber crew, and my job was to guide the pilot, keep us from getting lost, and find our way home after the raids and so forth.
And were you drafted or enlisted?
I enlisted. I registered for the draft as a senior in high school and received a draft notice before I graduated from high school, but was deferred. And meanwhile, I enlisted in the Army Air Corps, which today is the Air Force.
Can you tell me, you were a navigator on a B-17, so it was your job to guide the pilot. How did you do your job? How did you accomplish your task?
Well, it took a year of training, and we were trained in two types of navigation. One was called dead reckoning, and that was using a compass, a magnetic compass, and you used the airspeed meter and a drift meter, and you plotted your course on the map. The name dead reckoning was if you didn't reckon right or figure correctly, you could end up lost and be dead. The other type of navigation we used was celestial navigation. And there we used the sun in the daytime and the moon and different stars at night to navigate by. So we were trained in the use of a sextant, which was very interesting and quite technical. We also were trained in radio, so we could take radio bearings and so forth. But the navigator and the radio operator worked together quite often to keep track of where we were. I was a young lad at just barely 19, and our crew picked up a new plane in Savannah, Georgia, and we flew up the East Coast to Newfoundland, Newfoundland to the Azores, and Azores to North Africa, and then up to Italy. And the hop from Newfoundland to the Azores is about 1,800 miles, about 9 hours over water in the daytime. And I checked my figures quite often to make sure we were doing okay. We got there okay.
So you started out in Italy, and what was the name of the place in Italy?
Our air base was near Foggia, Foggia.
Foggia.
That was about in the middle of the Italian boot, so to speak. Just opposite the spur, there's a spur on the west coast, and we were just opposite that.
Tell me what happened once you got to. I see you were in the service from June of 43 to November of 45. So tell me what happened once you arrived in Italy. Then what happened afterwards?
Well, we left our new plane at a modification center, and we were assigned to the 353rd Squadron. And what they would do, they would take a new or a green crew and split us up. And the first few missions that we flew would be with experienced crews. And that was to get us used to handling combat conditions and so forth. And after about five missions, they'd bring the crew back together and you would fly it with your original crew. At that time, most of our targets were synthetic oil plants and railroad yards. And the synthetic oil plants come about because the oil fields in Romania had already been destroyed, the Polesti oil fields, and that was where Hitler was getting most of his oil and gasoline from. So he had to resort to an alternative source of fuel, and he was taking coal, making gasoline and fuel, diesel fuel from it. This required large amounts of water. So most of these synthetic oil plants were located along the Danube River, all the way from Vienna clear up almost into Germany. The idea, the strategy was to pinch the fuel supply down on Hitler's war machine. And it eventually did take place. We saw fewer fighter planes in the air from the Luftwaffe. And Hitler was at the point where he had to decide, am I going to use gasoline for trucks or tanks or airplanes? And it really had an effect on his war machine.
How many missions did you fly, approximately?
I'm not superstitious, but I went down in my 13th.
You're still not superstitious,
no,
though.
No, no. I survived it. We were on a night mission, headed for Linz, Austria. We went down on engine trouble. What had happened was the weather turned bad in the fall of the year in late November, and we couldn't fly these mass bombing missions where we would put up 200-300 bombers at a time. It was too dangerous to fly formation in cloudy weather. So they started what they call nuisance raids, and they would pick a target and send single planes over that target, different headings, different altitudes, keep the anti-aircraft gunners on alert 24/7. And it was more of a creating a stressful environment for the Germans rather than being very effective. But we went down on engine trouble.
Okay. I just want to make sure that I understand the timeline of what happened. It was your 13th mission. When did the plane go down? Like what month, what year?
The day after Thanksgiving, 1944. But we were about 100 miles from our target. We lost the oil in number one engine. We were about 150 miles from our target and lost the oil pressure in number one engine. And a few moments later, the control on engine number three, which controls the RPMs, blew a fuse and the engine went out of control. And the plane went into a steep spiral dive. We went from 25,000 feet down to about 18 in a matter of a couple minutes. The pilot regained control of the plane. We salvaged our bombs unarmed because we only had two good engines. The pilot couldn't feather number one engine, so it was windmilling and getting hot with no oil in it, catching on fire. So we had to bail at night and over northern Yugoslavia. I was loose 2 days before I got captured. Eight of the fellows got back to Italy through the partisan underground. The bombardier broke an ankle and he was captured. That was the end of my combat tour.
What did you do for those 2 days? How did you survive on the run for 2 days?
Tried to avoid detection. When I bailed at night, a parachute got caught in a tree, fortunately. It was over country a lot like the Black Hills, low mountains. I ended up about 10 feet from the ground, uninjured. And this was up in an area where there wasn't a lot of civilization, occasional farm and some small villages. So the first night I slept out in the woods. And then the second day I figured that if I was going to make contact with partisans, I'd probably better get to an area where there was more civilization. So I started following a stream. I got hemmed in between some fairly high cliffs and this stream, and I didn't want to get wet crossing the stream. And I noticed this bridge, which was a small bridge, and so I crossed it and got about 100 yards, and I heard somebody holler, "Halt!" And I turned around, and it's a German soldier with a rifle pointed at me, and I had not seen him. He was standing inside of a nearby building out of the rain, and so that was the end of my freedom.
Can you just very briefly tell me what the partisan underground was that you were alluding to?
Well, at this time in Yugoslavia, there was a civil war going on between the partisans and the communists. But Germany had occupied the country as far as the large cities, they controlled the railroads and so on. But out in the boondocks, there was this civil war going on, and partisans would fight the communists trying to get control of certain areas. But they would join forces to fight the Germans when they had to. And so it was a real different situation. If the partisans picked you up, they would return you to Allied forces. If the communists picked you up, they might trade you to the Germans for some of their prisoners to get back. So your destiny was somewhat unknown if you got picked up by Tito's forces. And there was no real way to identify these forces because they weren't in uniform, an underground movement.
So you were in a situation that was completely different than any other part of Europe.
Right.
making it even more difficult to navigate an already difficult situation.
Well, the second day I was on the ground, I was on this mountain trail looking down, and I saw a man with a rifle and a police dog. I wasn't sure whether he had seen me or not cross the trail, so I ran off and hid 100 yards or more off the trail, and it was raining. A man come up and stopped just about where I'd crossed the trail and hollered, "Hello," kind of in a accent like hello, and he sicked the dog around, but the dog couldn't pick up my scent because it was raining. And I think there I missed my chance of making contact with a partisan, but I was afraid to do it.
Well, I can understand why. So tell me what happened then when you got captured.
Well, first I spent a day or two with this outpost, German outpost that was holding out against the partisans. Then I was taken to a jail in a larger city. After a few days, I was combined with a group of seven other flyers, and we got two guards, and they put us on a train, and we went up into southern Germany to Munich. While in Munich was one of the scariest times I think I had during the war. We were waiting in the railroad depot. We had to change trains, and we had about a six-hour layover. Eight prisoners and two guards were sitting on this bench, and of course the German civilians would come and go as the rail trains arrived and departed. But we were an oddity. Of course, Munich had been bombed. We weren't too well liked. They knew we were flyers, and they would shake their fists at us and spit at us. And a young Hitler youth had agitated the crowd. Pretty soon we were completely surrounded by civilians, and there was a possibility of maybe being lynched or something. And finally one of the guards took his Luger pistol out of his holster, and he said, "Auschmidt, Auschmidt," and he made a pass through the crowd, and they took us down in the men's restroom in the basement, and that's where we waited for our train. So we had respect for our guards. Didn't want to get too far away from them.
What were conditions like on the train?
This particular train ride, they were normal, I would say. After we had been transported to an interrogation center, where we spent about a week, then we were transferred to a temporary prison camp called a Dulag Luft. Then they collected maybe 200-300 of us and made a special POW train, and they shipped us up to northern Germany.
And were you in boxcars, packed into boxcars?
We were packed into passenger cars, but I mean really packed too. We had no place to lay down to sleep or anything, and we were on the road 4 days. We would take turns sleeping in the luggage racks up above to get a little shut-eye.
Did you have to stand then? You were packed in there to stand?
No, we were sitting.
We're sitting.
It was an interesting ride, but yet a kind of a scary ride, because we went through Berlin, we went through Koblenz, and a couple other large cities that were bombed by the Allies. And at one time, we were in one of the large cities when the air raid sirens were going off, and you just never knew, you know, whether your buddies were going to drop some bombs on you or not.
I can't imagine how that must have felt.
Well, Berlin was pretty well, the heart of most of these cities had been really destroyed, especially around the railroad centers and so on. POW train finally ended up at Barth, Germany, on the south coast of the Baltic Sea, 60 miles south of Sweden. It was an agricultural area. The camp originally was a Hitler youth camp that had been converted to a POW camp. We had 10,000 flying officers in this camp by the end of the war, mostly Americans, but quite a few British, some Canadian, and some Australian. Most of our guards were retired school teachers that spoke English, so we didn't really have much of a language problem.
What were conditions like in the prison camp?
I would say they were halfway reasonable. Our biggest problem was sanitation and food. We were short of food. The Germans give us a bowl of horse meat stew and two slices of dark bread a day. And when they were available, they would be supplemented by Red Cross parcels, which we were to get one 15-pound food parcel per man per week. That never really happened, because the food parcels that we received would come from Sweden by boat to a port called Rostock, which is about 40 miles from the camp. Then they had to be transported by rail. And of course, POW food parcels was bottom priority on the German transportation system. We'd probably average about a half a food parcel per man per week. One time we went 6 weeks without any food parcels, and that's when it got kind of tough.
What were the guards like?
They were elderly. Most of them were 65, 70 years old, maybe 75. Too old for active infantry duty, but old enough to carry a gun and to shoot. Most of them were fairly friendly, but they had their rules, and if you didn't abide by them, well, you'd get solitary confinement and bread and water for a few days.
What were some of the rules?
Well, number one, we weren't allowed to taunt the guards or to tease them. Another rule was we were not allowed to assemble in groups more than about 10 or 15, except during roll call. Lights were supposed to be out at 8 o'clock in the evening, and the shutters closed on the barracks buildings. When you had roll call, you'd better hop to and get out there. We got counted twice a day. We would try and figure out little things to make life a little bit miserable for the guards. One little trick we used was on roll call, if the weather was real nice, we would line up by files and rank, and we would leave a vacant space in the middle of the formation, a couple of vacant spaces. Well, they would go along and they'd count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on, multiply that by the number of men in the file and come up with a figure. Well, they knew how many men should be in our compound, and they would always end up long, and that used to agitate them. But if the weather was cold or rainy or something, well, we'd all line up correctly, and 5 minutes or so, we'd be back in the barracks, and they knew that we were pulling their leg on this roll call bit, but they couldn't. I mean, it used to frustrate them.
Did they retaliate against you guys for doing that?
No. Roll call for 10,000 men is quite a job. And of course, the camp was divided into five different areas or compounds, and they did it by compounds. But there was always a few that were sick, couldn't make the formation, so then they'd have to check the barracks for those that were laying in their bunks. And occasionally, if the guys thought they could get away with it, they might stuff a bunk with rolled up blankets or something so it looked like somebody was there. And if the guard was walking through in a hurry, he might count that as a person.
So there was a little bit of joking going on here, trickery.
You had to have the joking and the humor in order to
keep
surviving,
going.
Right?
Can you tell me what the barracks were like, what your living conditions were like?
There were one-story barracks, probably about 10 rooms, maybe 20 by 24. The barracks were up on posts, so we couldn't start a tunnel underneath the barracks. They had pretty well thought out things. We had a central building for a washroom. Water was cold. We got locked in the barracks after 8 o'clock in the evening. There'd be one guard and two police dogs outside the barracks in the compound patrolling the area. And we used to try and bait the police dogs once in a while. They were taught not to eat anything unless they were fed by their master. But we tried breaking glass and mixing it with meat and tried feeding them that or leaving it lay outside, but they wouldn't touch it. We finally figured out one way to take the dogs out of commission. We had short pieces of boards and double-edged razor blades, and we would break the razor blades in half and put them in the boards with the sharp edge up. And the dogs would, at night, would patrol underneath the barracks, and like animals, they would had a certain path that they would follow, and so the fellows would drop these boards off just before dark and then pick them up early in the morning. And the dogs, after a while, had sore feet. It took a while, but eventually a dog would be out of commission, and you'd see a different dog on the beat.
How did you guys get razor blades?
Through the Red Cross parcels.
So you worked with what you had.
Right.
What was the worst day of those 6 months?
That's a difficult question. I don't know, really. One of the fellows, I think, last night said that there are bad days, but there are always better days. The bad days were around the holiday season. I was in there during Christmas and New Year's, and you know, you get to thinking of your parents and your girlfriend, and I never received any mail in 6 months. And I used to keep thinking about my folks. Here I am, missing in action. What are they going through? Do they know I'm alive? That type of a situation probably was the toughest to deal with. I was missing in action for about not quite 2 months as far as my parents were concerned. When we first entered the permanent prison camp, why, the German said, here, fill out a postcard and we'll send it home. Later we found out these postcards were used on propaganda broadcasts. We were tipped off ahead of time not to say anything against the Germans, and then they would be broadcast. And of course, if they were broadcast on their propaganda program, then our parents would know that we were alive. My father received probably 15-20 radiograms from amateur radio operators along the East Coast that had been monitoring the German propaganda program. Some of them were complete messages, others were partial, that they had picked up over the airwaves.
So your parents learned that you were alive and in a POW camp because of amateur radio operators on the East Coast?
Partly. The Red Cross, International Red Cross, did notify them officially. I'm sure they went through some anxious weeks, you know.
What kept you going, and what were you most looking forward to when you got home?
Well, what kept me going was just, you couldn't feel sorry for yourself because everybody else was in the same predicament in the camp. And so humor got to be a key to survival in a way. But human beings can be mean too. Sometimes we would make fun or make light of some fellow, kind of pick on him until he'd get mad and have a temper deal and maybe end up hitting somebody hard or something, and then we'd lay off.
Were you ever picked on?
Well, I received the nickname of Moe, M-O-E, for short for Moran. I didn't get picked on too much.
Why do you think that was?
I don't know.
Did you, in turn, were you a regular picker-onner?
I wasn't too aggressive, no.
Now, you said you had a girlfriend back home.
Yes.
Did she become your wife?
Yes. We were high school sweethearts.
What has she told you about what she was going through, how she felt when you were held for those 6 months?
Well, she was probably in about the same situation as my folks, not knowing whether I was dead or alive for a while. But then when she found out I was a prisoner, why, of course, she was happy that I was alive. And when I got back stateside, I went to see her before I went home to see my parents. I wanted to make sure she was waiting. And I hadn't received any mail, neither, and she hadn't received any mail from me, so it was quite a joyous reunion.
Earlier I asked you about what got you through those bad days, and you told me about that, but I forgot the second part of that question, which was, what were you most looking forward to when you returned home, and what was that?
Good food, and getting to see your sweetheart and your parents, clean shower, clean clothes. Lice was a problem in prison camp. We'd get a shower about once every 6 weeks, but we were sleeping on straw mattresses and they were infected with lice and fleas. So you kind of felt like you were a bunch of monkeys scratching here and scratching there.
What's the one thing you'd like people of my generation to understand, either about World War II or about your experience?
Well, I think the thing to understand is that freedom is not free. It has its price. I think that we have to guard the freedom in our country, even if it means guarding it with our lives. Our current situation with the Islamic terrorists is a very difficult one, I think. I hope that the movement dies out before it becomes a major conflict. My sympathy goes out with the servicemen in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Did the two of you ever talk about what happened during those 6 months? Did you tell her about your experience, or were you so happy to be together and then you never spoke about your war service with her again?
No, I spoke about it quite often. Little things would happen that would remind you of experiences. It wasn't that painful for me. I mean, I hadn't seen, if you excuse the term, the blood and guts of person-to-person combat and that sort of thing. That was one reason why I joined the Army Air Corps, was I did not have a flair for infantry combat. In the Air Corps, you either lived or you died, but you didn't get all of the gory parts of things.
So you were sort of being realistic and sort of planning ahead in a way when you enlisted in the Air
But
Corps. You had a reason for doing that.
yet at the time, I didn't realize the odds of being a flyer because the casualty rate was pretty high. I think Bill Huggett had the statistic that in order to finish 25 missions, less than 50% of the fellows ever did.
Not very good odds.
No, it isn't.
I bet. Are you glad that you didn't know those odds then?
Yes,
Yes. What did you learn about yourself during the war?
Well, I learned patience. You wait for the day that you're going to be released from prison camp. I also strengthened my faith in God and was thankful to be alive. And I think I learned to appreciate the little things in life.
Was there anything you learned about yourself that surprised you? Anything you didn't know you had it in you in some way, shape, or form, or anything like that?
As I look back, I think I was young and somewhat courageous and somewhat innocent, and I feel that I matured while I was in the service. I went from a teenager into a young man. When I got home, I was ready to resume or assume adult responsibilities. I got married before I started college, and I ended up graduating with a degree in civil engineering. Went through on the GI Bill, which I think was the best piece of legislation ever passed. I think the government got the biggest bang for their money on that GI Bill. I mean, the nation benefited by it too.
So you left your sweetheart and your parents as a teenager, and you came back as a man. And what did they think of that?
Well, I think they were proud of me, and they were happy to have me back.
Was your sweetheart ready to assume the roles of adulthood too,
I think so,
responsibilities?
yeah.
Because I'm sure she had changed during that time too.
Somewhat, yeah.
Yeah. At this point, is there anything else you'd like to share with me, Art, about your story, your experience?
No, I think that we've pretty well summed it up.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Art, for your service to our country and for visiting with me today.
You're welcome.